It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, executive editor Jill Abramson was just fired from the New York Times. We'll find out what the move might say about women in high-level jobs and in the media.
First, we're focusing on the latest news on potential changes to campaign finance laws in Wisconsin. Yesterday, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said Republican lawmakers would pursue a complete overhaul of campaign finance laws in Wisconsin. The news comes after a recent appeals court ruling that shot down existing laws on campaign money here in the Badger State, referencing a new U.S. Supreme Court decision.
Dennis Riley is with us to help put this into context. He's a professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point. Dennis, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Well, we've heard some of the details there, but big picture, are we seeing a rapid pullback from regulation on campaign spending here in the state?
Oh, there's no question about that. And we'll see, the formalization of that process probably next year, I think, because I'm sure that when the legislature convenes in January of 2015, that'll be fairly high on the list of things to do. And they'll be presumably, at least they believe right now, they'll be the Republican majority. They'll still have a Republican governor, and they'll be able to do as they choose. We'll see if that's really true, but that's what they expect.
And Assembly Speaker Robin Voss on the Assembly side, Senator Mary Lozick, chair of the Elections Committee on the Senate side, say they want to change the laws, bring them into line with the recent court rulings. Just running through those, the state now has agreed to stop enforcing a cap on individual contributions to candidates, and that's following with a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. And then last week, a federal judge said, hey, independent groups that don't disclose their donors can coordinate with candidates. How big, just those two alone, how big a difference does that make to our elections here?
Well, it's hard to say in the context of the sort of non-enforcement of the rules against those things that we've seen for the past couple of election cycles. We haven't seen those vigorously enforced in either in any kind of elections the last couple of years. But it will make a change because now we all will know those things are perfectly okay. And in fact, it's hard to see what sort of money activity isn't okay. There are still going to be donation limits of sorts directly to candidates, but that's going to be pretty insignificant given the ability to spend massive sums of money clearly for or against someone, as long as you don't trigger certain words in that statement. And so it's pretty much going to be a wide open river for money to flow through.
You mentioned that kind of last bastion now of campaign finance laws. I can only donate a finite amount directly to a particular candidate. Do you think the way courts have been ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court on down that could be the next domino to fall?
I would imagine it would be, since it's one of the two or three left standing to knock over. And if everything the court has said up to now, which all points in one direction, that spending money in a political way is the same thing as me standing on the street corner on an old-fashioned soapbox and saying, this is what I think we all ought to do collectively, that if spending money is exactly the same thing as that, then how can you prevent spending? I mean, I suppose you can still say that a donation isn't an expenditure, but I don't think they'll try to hold that line. So my guess is, yeah, they'll take that down next.
You know, from the progressive era after the Gilded Age through the post-Watergate era onto McCain-Feingold, there was the counter-argument to that, the counterweight, saying that campaign money was a form, in effect, of corruption or corrupted the political process. Why has that argument fallen so out of favor, at least in the courts?
Well, I think there are probably a couple of reasons, one of which is that there are people with so very much money who want to be influential in the political process in ways that perhaps they stopped wanting to be at some point along the way. I don't know. But, you know, you have the Koch brothers, Adelson, the rest of that sort of set of people. But there are lots and lots of others who want to be really influential, and their money is an opportunity, and they want to knock these kinds of things down. And they meet a very conservative set of justices who, excuse me, in some cases are bordering toward the libertarian when it comes to the role of business and the role of economic power. They're not when it comes to the role of government in the national security state by any means, but they are in other areas. And so I think that a very receptive set of justices and a very aggressive set of millionaires and billionaires who want to remain so and even increase their wealth, that confluence is where we're going, and we're going there fast now.
Campaign finance reform advocates, one strategy they've used to kind of get around this is the notion of public financing of campaigns, saying, you know, if you agree to certain election standards, you'll get some state money to run your campaign. Are any of those still standing? Have those all been struck down along the way?
I don't know if they've all been struck down as such, but they've all been made moot, in effect, by the fact that almost no one is willing to agree. And progressives have to admit that President Obama kind of kicked that in the head pretty thoroughly by saying, I can outraise these guys, and I'm going to, and then I'm going to outspend them, and doing it twice. So, I mean, he sort of undermined the progressive case for public financing. And I think I don't know that you could get even a Democratic legislature to agree to it now, but you certainly couldn't get a legislature with any Republican power to agree to it. So I think it's pretty much a dead horse at the moment. And that was really the progressives' primary line of defense, was to say, well, if we could do that, we could eliminate money in politics. And if we can't do that, and if money is speech, you're just going to watch the money go and go and be spent and be spent.
Is this a pendulum? You know, we move to one extreme and then back to the other and back and forth, or are we just setting out a road that we're going to keep going down here?
Well, my fear is that we're on a road that will be down long after my career is over. I think we're going to be on this for a fairly long period of time. John Roberts is a relatively young man. He intends to stay there and stand and defend that vision of money as speech, and Sam Alito will be there to defend it. Now, it's true that Scalia's getting older and Kennedy's getting older, but who knows under what administration they'll be replaced, and those are all kind of tricky, and there are an awful lot of legislatures jumping on that bandwagon. It doesn't seem to be anybody effectively standing between the flow of money and every election that we hold. There doesn't seem to be anybody that's very effective in standing there. So it's going to be, I mean, even like Elizabeth Warren, who's very effective standing or trying to be effective standing there with respect to banks and all the rest of that, one of the things you see in every article about her is an incredible amount of money she raised in her 2012 campaign against Scott Brown. And so, you know, it just seems like it's hard for anybody to stand there and say, we've got to stop this, and then is credible while saying so.
The couple eras I mentioned, the progressive era and the post-Watergate reforms, both following on what were perceived as major scandals related to the influence of money in politics. Is there a possibility of some kind of scandal like that turning public opinion on this issue?
I hate to do nothing but be pessimistic, but at this moment I don't see that. Because I don't see the public thinking that there's an alternative, a viable alternative to that. I think the public believed there was in the progressive era, and I think they believed there was in Watergate. When you think of the scandal surrounding money in the Nixon campaign and the Watergate campaign, that's such a small amount of money now, and it was so close to almost honest relative to the kinds of things that go on now, because we were still in an era when basically what candidates did was raise a whole lot of money for themselves and their party, and nobody else was playing. But now that you've got all kinds of independent players, even if they're all funded by, you know, 25 billionaires, still there's a lot of different versions of that out there. I just don't see any swell of public outrage or even public frustration right now.
We'll leave it there. Dennis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Dennis Riley, professor of political science at UW Stevens Point.
New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson was abruptly fired from the paper Wednesday, less than 3 years after she was appointed the first woman in this top media job.
Now, the media world is abuzz with speculation over exactly why this happened. One theory that's getting a lot of play is that she had confronted her bosses about her compensation, which she said was substantially lower than that of her male predecessor, Bill Keller.
Her dismissal also highlights the ongoing struggle of women to break through the glass ceiling. And when they do break through, like Abramson, do they have to be tough and demanding and likable? Rachel Laris from the Women's Media Center joins us now. She oversees their media monitoring program. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there's been a lot of speculation about the exact reasons for Jill Abramson's dismissal, but The New Yorker, CNN, other media outlets have saying that it may have been because she confronted her boss about pay discrepancy between herself and her predecessor. What do we know about the why?
Well, we don't know. We actually don't know all the facts because the New York Times has not actually been very transparent about why Jill Abramson was let go. You know, we do know that she wasn't dismissed because of her management of the editorial content in the New York Times. It was actually doing quite well. So, but if the reports are to be true, it seems that Abramson was judged by a different standard than her predecessors.
And there is the why, which we don't know, and there seems to be a lot of back and forth about it was compensation, it wasn't compensation. But on another level, does it really matter why she was dismissed when sort of the big story is, you know, a top woman executive fired, and this also coming close to a similar situation with Le Monde, the paper in France, where the top woman editor there was fired too. Does it matter how much why?
Well, I think it could matter, but I think the way that the Times has handled this situation is actually is why many people have thought that her gender might be a contributing factor. And honestly, the outcry and the bad publicity that this is really generating for the Times, I think, really demonstrates how much the issue of gender disparity really can't be swept under the rug these days. You know, some people I've heard are talking about unsubscribing because of the actions of the publisher, and I think other newspapers should really take note about how badly the Times looks in this situation.
Why haven't we heard from Jill Abramson herself? Do you think she has a confidentiality agreement?
I think a non-disparagement agreement is probably a common thing that that most people have to sign when they leave.
As far as women in the media go, we've got the one hand, you know, looking at the compensation issues, and at the other, there have been reports citing that it was more of her demeanor in the newsroom and that she may have been pushy or overly aggressive in creating a certain kind of atmosphere, which raises a whole different set of questions about expectations for women and how they comport themselves when they're in these high-level jobs. What do you think is key to that discussion?
It's really interesting to know that past New York Times editors have been known to be, you know, brusque with staff, and they were still actually seen as effective. You know, Harold Raines was also known to be not particularly well liked in the newsroom, and he was actually not let go because of his unpopularity. He was let go over the scandal of Jason Blair and plagiarism, which was really the issue that was embarrassing the paper, not how Harold Raines treated his staff. And, you know, when the famed executive editor Abe Rosenthal died, his obituary actually noted that he was, and this is a direct quote, that he was abrasive, a man of dark moods, and he could humble a subordinate for an error. This was in his obituary, and he was seen as, he's one of the famed editors, past editors of the New York Times.
Well, you hear quotes like that, and they almost sound like a badge of honor.
For men, it might be, but obviously women are judged by different standards than men.
What is the current picture in other media organizations? How do the numbers of women in editorial roles like this in the newsroom compare, you know, in other media landscapes?
You know, it's precisely because there are so few women and, frankly, people of color occupying top leadership positions in the media is why I think this firing is really having such resonance. You know, with the Women's Media Center in our Status of Women in the U.S. Media Report, which was released earlier this year, noted that across all daily newspapers, women comprised only 36% of newsrooms and were only 34% of supervisors. And our own research of the bylines of the New York Times that we just put out a few months ago found that the male reporters were dominating the paper by writing 69% of the news articles in the New York Times.
And what about the compensation? Do we know anything about whether the men writers are getting paid more than the women writers?
You know, we would, I think the public and a lot of people would be really interested to know, but the fact of the matter is across all industries, women are paid less than men, and this has been verified by both the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau. So I have no reason to believe, we have no reason to believe that the situation in the newspapers would be different than the rest of the work industry.
We hear a lot, you know, lately the expression lean in has gotten a lot of traction thanks to Sheryl Sandberg talking about how women need to step it up and, you know, kind of deliver maybe even more than their male counterparts. But is that really, I don't know, a good strategy? I wonder, looking at something like this, some people are saying leaning in can get you fired. What is the right strategy for a woman in a top job?
Every woman is going to have to make a decision of what she feels comfortable in doing in terms of her particular work situation. This is why systematic change is actually really what's important and why groups like the Women's Media Center make a point to calling attention to the gender disparity where it exists. Because if you don't identify the problem, you can't change it. And I think systematically, this is something that can only be done as a systematic level rather than putting the burden of the effort on individual women to change men and the world's behavior. It's something that we all have to do, and it has to be done, with intention.
Well, let's talk about that. You're calling for systematic changes so it doesn't fall on individual women, which makes a lot of sense. What kind of changes are you calling for?
You know, at least in terms of the media, we have in our Status of Women in Media report, we actually have a list of recommendations that we have run for ways that we can at least change the gender representation in the media, and that includes, you know, simple things like staffing with intention, having outlets be aware of who they're, you know, the ratio of hiring, and also things like what type of sourcing who they're talking to. One interesting study of the front page stories of the New York Times noted that in addition to men obviously writing more of the front page stories, men were also quoting more male sources. And so I think it was at four times as many as the number of, as the stories that were written by women. So even keeping track of who the newspapers are quoting is a really great way of just noting the differences in men's voices and women's voices in the media.
A lot of people in the media, including, you know, National Public Radio, are interested in hearing from diverse voices. Isn't this something that's already happening in newsrooms?
I hear a lot of good intentions, and I think that it is something that could be changed. But I think a lot of outlets aren't really keeping track of these numbers. This is actually why the Women's Media Center, in order to help reporters, has actually created a She Source database of women experts so that any booker or reporter who's looking for a female expert on any topic, really, can come to shesource.org and find great women experts so that they can never say, honestly, I looked and I couldn't find any woman to talk about finance or about the environment or about healthcare. So the women experts are out there. I just think that it sometimes reporters can get very, I hate to say it, but lazy and go back to the same people over and over again instead of searching out new voices.
Obviously, a systematic change like that would take some time to implement. In the meantime, there's a cultural thing going on, at least reportedly it seems to be going on, that, you know, women, they haven't broken through in equal numbers in lots of the top paying jobs, like CEOs and executive editors, journalism and elsewhere. What about that problem, you know, when they do break through, what they might confront culturally in the office?
Yeah, that's a real issue, and I think that that's why it's really important for groups to continue talking about the concept of inherent institutional sexism. I think there's sort of a concept that sexism is something that sexism is only implicit if you think that, you know, women, you don't want women to have the right to vote or not to have a job, and that's just not true. There can be systematically ways that discriminate against women, one of which is how they may be penalized for either having children or not having children, or even as you say, their demeanor in the office. These are ways that women can be systematically discriminated against in ways that their employers and managers and supervisors may not even be aware that they're doing.
We're going to continue this discussion with Rachel Laris of the Women's Media Center in just a bit, talking about Jill Abramson's dismissal from the New York Times and what it could say about women in top media positions and other high-ranking positions.
It's 4:36. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're exploring what New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson's dismissal earlier this week could mean for women in the media. With us is Rachel Laris, communications manager for the Women's Media Center, where she oversees their media monitoring program.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Would you like to hear, as our guest does, more women's voices in the media, whether as journalists, broadcasters, editors, or sources? Do you think women face unique challenges, especially as they enter the upper echelons of the workplace, media or otherwise? What are those challenges? Do you see them where you work? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
We're going to go right to our callers now and take Steve from Rhinelander. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. I would like to compliment the people doing this show. I hear two very talented and articulate women, and I think that just kind of proves the point that the only thing necessary is just to have the person that's best qualified for the job get the job, rather than putting up artificial barriers because someone happens to be a man, you know, rather than discriminating against men. I think that everyone should be judged equally. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for the great program.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for the compliment. Rachel, is that enough to just go for the best person?
You know, it's interesting because in hiring, when sometimes what ends up happening is that people define the person who's most qualified as somebody who looks and sounds and maybe is educated the exact same way that they are. And so, therefore, it's the concept of defining who is really well qualified that you end up seeing that kind of homogeneity in hiring. So, and it's really to the news media's benefit that they expand their hiring portion beyond just a small circle of white men that typically are hired and promoted. And this is because they'll get better stories. They'll get better voices. They will not be blind to sort of demographic changes that are happening in this country. You know, minorities actually comprise only 13% of newsrooms, despite 37% of this country not being white. And I don't have the figures for women at the New York Times, but I know that they are only 19% of the newsroom. The New York Times is actually non-white, so the newsroom is not reflecting the readership, and I think that it should.
A lot of the coverage that at least I've seen all of it, but it tends to reflect rather poorly on the New York Times. I've read some stories saying that this was a humiliating way for Jill Abramson to have gotten fired, that it was abrupt, that it may have been unfair in terms of her asking for compensation. But do you think that something like this happening and unfolding the way it has could deter people from hiring women because they're worried about backlash?
I don't think it should deter. If anything, I think that this is an example of why it's important to have women, because the lack of women in top roles are really getting a lot of attention these days. Media Matters, for instance, just put out an infographic that noted that with Jill Abramson's departure, there's only two women who are the top editors of the top 25 newspapers in the U.S. It's Newsday and Houston Chronicle both have women as executive editor, and they are the only two newspapers that are headed by a woman right now. And that's, I think, something that is going to get a lot more attention, you know, even in the next few days. And so I suspect that a lot of media owners are going to be thinking, how can they avoid this sort of bad publicity, especially when they may be called to account by other, you know, by other reporters and, frankly, outlets like yourself.
What do you hope the New York Times management does going forward to communicate a willingness to be fair and to, I guess, be in good faith when they're working with women and minorities?
What was really great about Jill Abramson was she had a strong responsibility to promoting gender diversity as well as frankly pay equity. And when we at the Women's Media Center showed her our study of the New York Times bylines and asked for a comment, she acknowledged that they were not doing as good as they could, but pledged to do better. And under her dominion, they actually, the masthead of the New York Times, I think, was up to 50% women. So that's really, those are some really great strides. And I would like to hope that in the wake of this news, that the publisher and the new executive editor will continue this kind of work and make sure that women's voices are well represented, as well as voices of people of color.
Is it important, do you think, that the New York Times, you know, does that going forward, considering, you know, the kerfuffle that we're in right now over this? How important is it that the New York Times really does come forward and try to encourage women to and be represented in their company and elsewhere?
I think the paper, with its lack of transparency about this situation and the way that this is really turning into some bad publicity for them, has a responsibility to their readership and to the public. I mean, there's a reason the New York Times is very proud of themselves and being called the paper of record, and they are going to want to restore their credibility and their readership's faith by, I think, taking steps to make sure that the men and women who work there can expect to be paid equally for equal work and can expect to be not discriminated against because of their gender or their color.
I have been reading lately that we need to focus more on the men when we talk about gender equity in the workplace. How have men been left out of this conversation?
I'm curious. You've heard that men are being discriminated against?
Men have not been discriminated against, but when we're encouraging a culture that's positive for women and allows women to rise, that men need to be included in that conversation and to be made to feel that they're stakeholders as well as the women.
Well, change is never going to happen, you know, with only 50%, change doesn't happen when only the group that is affected wants change. Change happens when there is a force that, frankly, can require the groups that are being disempowered, the groups that are in power from buying in. I think that it is important that men recognize that discrimination hurts them, and frankly, the concept of gender roles being strictly assigned to both men and women hurts them as much as women. So I think everyone benefits from the types of strides that feminist organizations and feminist leaders are trying to achieve. I have male friends that stay home, are stay-at-home dads, and they are not looked down upon for doing that. And I really think that this is the kind of changes that are important. They're happier now doing that than forcing themselves to be the breadwinner.
Rachel, are there things that media outlets and journalism schools can do to encourage women to break into the media now?
You know, there are great journalism schools, and I think that one of the things that I've really been noticing is a community of just sort of the interconnected community, the way that social media helps reporters across the country kind of stay in touch with trends. And so before, you would have a bunch of women working in a newsroom, and maybe it would just be literally a handful feeling really alone and feeling like, you know, we can't seem to make change just happen at our newspaper, and not realizing that there may be a whole group of women across the country that were feeling the same way. So I think the one of the benefits that has sort of happened in this sort of new social media age is the way that these conversations are happening, not just sort of in unhappy hours, I guess, between staffers who want to talk about their problems, but basically out in the public and, you know, with everybody. You know, the readers, I think the audience is taking part in this, the audience being, you know, newspaper readers and media consumers are taking part in this as much as journalists themselves. And I think that that is how we are going to get to a place of change.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for really being, you know, caring about this topic.
Absolutely. That was Rachel Laris, Communications Manager for the Women's Media Center, where she oversees their media monitoring program.
It's time to check in on what's making news in Wisconsin this week, from a proposal to outsource some UW system jobs to the death of former Governor Patrick Lucey. Our regular news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, joins us now. He's WPR's Assistant News Director. Noah, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's jump in on...
Are you sure? Can we just talk about Godzilla?
Well...
Can we just not talk about the
Just hang on until after
Let's talk about
news.
Movies. That's a lot. More fun.
It is fun stuff.
Stuff, yeah.
Well, sorry, man.
All right. Back to the news.
Well, we just mentioned possibly outsourcing some University of Wisconsin jobs. What are we talking about here?
So this was a story that Glenn Moberg had this week. Mike Simonson. Mike was the first to report that UW Superior gave its custodial and grounds crew what are called at-risk letters, which essentially indicate that tell these workers that they may be laid off and that their jobs will be outsourced.
So this is UW-Superior, one school among many. Why is this a big deal?
It's a big deal because it represents, you know, one possible reaction to the budgetary pressures the UW system as a whole is facing. I mean, obviously, there's the escalating cost of education. And there, of course, was a freeze in tuition last year, which has put more budgetary pressure on the UW system. And this is one way, this idea of outsourcing is one way that at least one campus is looking at cutting some costs.
And have we seen this before on campuses?
Yes, but this is actually, although it's the smallest of the four-year campuses, UW-Superior would be the first of the four-year campuses to actually consider outsourcing this kind of work.
And what's their financial situation at UW-Superior?
So like I said, they are the smallest campus, but they do have an annual operating deficit at last count of almost $1 million. And so the chancellor up there has said that, you know, they're going to be seeking proposals from private companies.
So the next question, I guess, is this going to be the first among many?
Yeah. Is this the beginning of a trend? I don't know. But I can tell you that the UW system president, Ray Cross, did tell Mike Simonson during the course of the reporting that he's done on this story that, you know, all campuses need to be looking at reductions. And part of the tools in that tool chest is outsourcing. Mm-hmm. So I think this is something we're probably going to at least hear about a lot more here in the coming months and years as the various campuses deal with the changing budgetary situation.
Well, that's one I'm sure we're going to be watching, you and the news team and us here at Central Time. Moving south now to Stevens Point, a word that's relatively new to me anyway, vaping is at the center of a story.
Yes, vaping. Glenn Moberg had this story this week. Stevens Point is struggling with how to regulate these so-called vaping bars. And, you know, I wanted to talk about this particular story because, you know, this is a debate that is not unique to Stevens Point. Mm-hmm. And in Stevens Point case, it's a business wanting to open up there.
Let's get the basic here.
Yeah.
What is vaping?
So vaping, I don't want to bury the lead here, but vaping basically is these bars where you can go and smoke e-cigarettes, mm-hmm. basically. And, you know, not only is Stevens Point dealing with how to regulate these, but, you know, cities and towns across the state, across the country, are struggling to figure out how to deal with this new and increasingly popular technology that are e-cigarettes.
So what do we learn from Stevens Point? How are they juggling this, trying to manage whether or not we can have vaping bars.
So in Stephen's point, you know, they're debating, you know, not whether or not to have them per se, mm-hmm. because they are legal at this point. And if they were made illegal, I think the state and the federal government would have to get involved. But at this point, they're talking about, you know, whether to use zoning laws to restrict where these vaping bars can be located, as well as, you know, the licensing requirements. You know, what are the licensing requirements that are going to be had with businesses like this? I mean, this is new technology. Mm-hmm. How do we deal with it? Well, Stephen's point at this point doesn't know.
Well, nobody knows. Feds on down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there is so much unknown about this new technology. You know, as I mentioned before, the towns are struggling with this new technology. But, you know, the federal government as a whole, from the FDA all the way down to the EPA, is still figuring out what to do with e-cigarettes. I mean, we're still trying to figure out, you know, what are the health risks? Is it the secondhand vapor dangerous? You know, these are all questions that still need definitive answers. And frankly, both the state, local, federal governments are really lagging behind the increasing demand for these products.
You know, it's an interesting social situation, too. A couple years ago, I was sitting there at the board, and a guest was in the studio. I'm not going to name a name. And I saw him lean away from the microphone, and then puffs of vapor were coming up. I realized the guest during the interview was puffing an e-cigarette during the show. And I thought, should I ask him not to? I don't know. It's a new thing.
It is. I was at an airport in Minneapolis less than a year ago, and I remember I was sitting at a bar, and somebody across from me was smoking an e-cigarette. And, you know, it's been a while now since we've allowed smoking in restaurants, and I did like a triple take. I was like, what? At first I thought it was a real cigarette, and then I'm like, oh, it's an e-cigarette. And, you know, it took me by surprise, but, you know, this is going to be a scene that we're going to see more and more, and cities like Stevens Point and others are going to have to figure out how to deal with it because it's such new technology.
Well, and that's another one we'll keep checking in with you on as more municipalities and maybe the state weigh in on that issue. Well, some sad news. Former Governor Patrick Lucey, passed away since the last time we talked to you, Noah, last weekend.
Right, exactly. So this technically happened last week, but it is a big story mm-hmm. nonetheless. You know, there's so much to say about the former governor. You know, there is the long list of things he actually did as governor, mm-hmm. which include, you know, creating the modern UW system as it exists today.
Instead of independent campuses.
Exactly. He signed a same-day voter registration law. He created Wisconsin's shared revenue system. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, those are things that are kind of fundamental assumptions about so many of the things we talk about. Education funding, the university system, we were just talking about voter registration. Still controversial sometimes in Wisconsin, but he was there for the inception of those.
Right. I mean, so that's the legislation. You know, he's also credited by many for really bringing the Democratic Party to the forefront in Wisconsin politics at a time, frankly, when the GOP dominated politics in this state. He was really one of the few people to really bring the Democratic Party to the forefront. Former Governor Tony Earle was quoted as saying that he was, in addition to what he did for the party, was also one of the most effective governors, if not the most effective governor of the last 100 years.
And he had jobs outside of Wisconsin as well. One thing I didn't know until I heard the coverage of this last week, he was John Anderson's running mate in that independent presidential mm-hmm. campaign against Reagan and Carter in 1980.
Yeah, he was also an ambassador to Mexico during the Carter administration. He really did a lot. And I have to say, too, the other thing that I think makes him unique was the fact that many people talk about how he was, while he was a strident Democrat, he was somebody who was willing to sort of reach across the aisle to get things done. So a real big figure in Wisconsin politics, one that we lost last week.
Well, I want to move to our current governor now, Governor Scott Walker, making his a batch of endorsements, I guess, not here in Wisconsin, though.
Right. These are all endorsements for races outside of Wisconsin. And again, you know, I think this is the latest sign, really, that the governor, you know, continues to have his eyes on the long term. You know, it's also interesting, I think, that he's making these kinds of endorsements because these primaries have a huge field, you know, more than a few candidates in each one of these races. And, you know, with so many candidates, there is a bit more of a risk if you're endorsing any one candidate because there's, of course, a less of a chance that they might win. Mm-hmm. So very interesting.
Well, one thing that implies to me is that people want his endorsement. He's a big name in Republican circles, has been, especially since the recalls, the protests after Act 10.
Absolutely. What he did with Act 10, I think, certainly propelled him to the top of the Republican Party. I mean, he, by any measure, I think he is a star of the party. And it certainly doesn't hurt to have his endorsement if you're looking, especially looking to get through a Republican primary.
Now, are there any races in particular that you found interesting that he's getting involved in?
Yeah, he's supporting State Treasurer Doug Ducey in Arizona's gubernatorial race. Governor Walker also endorsed Pete Ricketts in the governor's race in Nebraska. At least in Ricketts' case, the support, you know, goes both ways. Pete Ricketts and his family donated something like $175,000 to Walker during the recall campaign. Also, a political action committee connected to Ricketts' father spent around $245,000 helping Walker during the recall as well. So there is a relationship there, certainly, between the Ricketts family and Governor Walker.
And some of these races have had votes now. Any sign of whether Governor Walker's endorsement made a difference?
Well, of course, we don't know for sure. But Pete Ricketts did win just barely. In fact, he won by something like 2,200 votes out of, you know, tens of thousands of votes cast. So a very tight race in the case of Pete Ricketts.
Now, one big question with Governor Walker, a lot of speculation in the media, is he going to run? Isn't he going to run for president in a couple of years? Of course, he says, hey, my attention is focused on this year, on the governor's race in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Are there tea leaves here we could read and weigh? Is he endorsing people in, say, Iowa, New Hampshire, early primaries?
I mean, you know, these are all, it's helpful to collect these IOUs at this point, because anybody, whether you're Governor Walker or somebody else, at least contemplating a future run for the presidency, these are the kind of IOUs you need to collect across the country if you're going to make your way through, especially, you know, Republican primaries, which at least in recent years have been, you know, quite competitive.
The kind of people you want to go around and endorse might be people who are heavily involved in the state's party committee, rallying people to vote in a primary or rounding up the people to vote in a caucus.
Right. And these are folks that, you know, not only have big names in the GOP, but also folks with obviously deep pockets.
Well, Noah, we'll leave it there until next week. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That was our news guy, WPR's assistant news director, Noah, the news hound, Ovshinsky. He joins us each week at this time to round up some of the big stories, ongoing stories in Wisconsin news and politics.
Coming up, we'll get a preview of this summer's blockbusters, like the latest spin on Planet of the Apes. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Hey, we got a second. Bring Noah's mic back up, will you, Michelle? Is there a movie you're looking forward to? Are you looking forward to Godzilla?
Absolutely, 100%. I can't wait to see it.
You're a Godzilla fan?
Yes.
All right.
I hate to burst your bubble, but I just read that Wired magazine said it was boring.
Don't say it.
Okay, never mind.
My ears are
I didn't say it.
Listening.
It's going to be amazing.
I can't wait.